Welcome to another episode of The Suspendables with funny man Jungle Jim Jerome and retired NHL star Russ Cortinel. Each week they unleash their raw, stripped down, unfiltered opinions on all things hockey and maybe other stuff too. Who knows? Inside stories, absolutely. Outrage, guaranteed. Offside, for sure. And always plenty of laughs. Strap in. The Suspendables is coming at you right now.
Okay, pull up the curtain. Here I am. Here's another show of The Suspendables. Yes, we live to tell another week. Great show last week. People very emotional about Russ's take on what's going on around the world. That was great. So finally, I say, we get Jeff Cortinel on. People have been asking for this for months and months and months. And I'm going to tell you something. Oh my God, I can't believe how much they hate each other. They don't get along. It was completely uncomfortable. I was trying to sew everything together. Jesus. Crazy. Stay tuned. Here we go, folks. Another episode of The Suspendables, or like I affectionately heard them called the other day with our guest who we're going to bring on. He says, we're setting up an interview with Jeff Cortinel, with Russ's brother, and Jeff gets back to me and goes, what time are we doing The Destructibles? So we've had a lot of people. We're having a great time doing the show. Rusty, you're in Gosser now, and we've had just so many people get back to us saying they love the show. We've had great shows. Still, Kelly Chase still holds the medal. We want to boot him off the podium for the best show we've done. The great one came on last week, Russ, this passionate hour that you did about the racial unrest and social injustice has just had this huge outpouring from people getting back to us. But the biggest one we've had for a request for a guest is, I get this every day. When are you fucking getting Jeff Cortinel on? I want to hear the real story. And we're joined by your brother now. Jeff, how are you, brother?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm really good. Yeah, I'm really good. Better for getting you on.
Yeah, well, it's great to hear your voice again.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a long time. But I've got to tell you, so I've known you probably longer than Russ because you slipped into town here, into Edmonton in 1988. Scooped a cup, okay, got a Stanley Cup, and you helped the Oilers win that. And then we were down in Phoenix, I think, for the fantasy camp, and you kept dumping shit all over my shoes, okay, without knowing what they call the shoe check. So I became a little frightened, eh, Russ, Jeff? I came a little fucking frightened. And then we were in the rink at a game. I had my shorts on, and I was shivering, you know? I was just freezing cold. I was behind the bench in one of the games, and I was chirping Jeff and his team, you know. And
yeah, we were losing like 8-3 or something.
Yeah, you're losing 8-3, and then next thing I know, I go into a full hypothermia, cardiac arrest, because Jeff dumped a 5-gallon drum of frozen Gatorade on me, okay, in the arena. And fucking Russ is, and Gretz is going, Jesus, Jeff, you're going to kill him. Get him in the hot tub. Get him in the hot tub. And I'm going, oh, my fucking God. Oh, my God, I've had heart. And then if that's not enough, he had a backup and dumped another one. And I was fucking frozen on the ground. And I said, Rusty, you never told me your brother's a fucking maniac, man. An absolute maniac. Do you remember that, Jeff?
Oh, I remember it clear. Bill Comrie was on my line, and we were losing badly, and you were yelling and screaming at us that we suck. So, of course, we had to shut you up and then make the comeback and win the game.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
the Gators.
I was crying.
Crying. We turned it around then. We poured the Gatorade on the losing coach.
Yeah. They say, everyone's screaming, you're going to kill him. Jeff was like, fuck that. Tell him to shut up. Yeah. Maybe this will stop him.
The best one, though, was Gretz was so nice to take all the guys out for dinner. And somebody said, oh, yeah, you better give Jimmy a shoe check. So I went down there, crawled under the table, got you. But the best one is you stood up and said, oh, my God, what is that? Wiped it all off and then said, you'll never get me again. Yeah. Which is like the worst thing you can say.
I know. I know. And so I'm sitting there. It's at, we're at this like 70-star restaurant, right?
That's so around. Good.
And I said, you'll never fucking get me again. And I put my feet up on the table, Russ. I put, said, you'll never get me again. I started talking and we were smoking cigars. And next thing I, you know, like 45 minutes later, I'm yapping away, telling jokes or something. And I hear, shoot check. My fucking heart drops, right? Because my feet were under the table. I got white pants on. I look down, and from my waist down, it looks like somebody fucking shot me. Okay? There's fucking ketchup and mayo and fucking mustard and hot sauce and spit and fucking...
Didn't Jesus. You say, but when Jeff... clanged the glass and yelled out "Shoe check!" Didn't you say "Who got it"?
Yeah,
I did. He did.
Who no. did? Who did but he I was get? Really in, I was,
all I just remember is the evil. I looked across the table and the evil, piercing eyes of Jeff looking at me, raising his eyebrow, going, "Maybe you should have a look, Jeff," because I didn't stand up, you know. And oh my God, but you. I mean, Jeff, you're kind of known, right, for the. You know, Russ has always said, we've told a million stories. Russ has got some great stories, and so do you from the NHL. And Russ said, you think I got stories? My brother Jeff, man, has got them like one after another from, and yeah. Was it Bergevin was your roommate who you guys used to prank everybody?
Well, Bergie and I only roomed together on one trip because McInnes was hurt and Hull wasn't on the trip because Brett was my roommate. But
right.
Yeah, so Bergie... Basically, it was nonstop with Bergie, but, the classic was when when we would get into the hotels, you know, it's funny. I can remember Neil Sheehy in Washington. Every time we'd get in, I'd fill out the menu for breakfast at 6 a.m. and I'd order, like, breakfast for 4 and put it on his door at midnight, and the waiters or whatever come around and grab it. And 6 in the morning, you could hear the guy out there banging. So the one morning, he's yelling room service. And the one morning, I couldn't handle it. I was laughing so hard in bed. I looked out the door, and the guys, they're yelling, "We didn't order room service." And the guy's got 2 carts, and he's going. Oh, God.
Yeah. Fuck. I love this shit because I'm writing it down. I want to do that.
Neil Sheehy would say in the dressing room, I'm going to call the hotel and say whose room's missing one of those menus. So I would go into the young guys' rooms and grab their menu and then fill it out at night.
Jeff, what about... Rudy Pocheck's new car. What did you guys do to him with the car or the key or was it Rudy Pocheck?
Well, Kelly Chase told that story, I think.
Oh, did he? Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. We already heard that story. Well,
didn't you just nick a little off the key every day? So go ahead. Yeah.
So what you do is you basically just touch the key on the skate grinder.
Yeah,
and basically you just keep taking a lick of, and it gets stiffer and stiffer and stiffer to all of a sudden it won't turn. Yeah, we did that to quite a few guys, but the best was I had a floor jack and I used to bring blocks in the back of my truck and the floor jack to the rink in Vancouver and jack the back of guys' cars up so they were just about a half an inch off the ground. And they're friggin' revving their engine and friggin' drive and the wheels are spinning and they can't figure out what's going on.
Who the fuck thinks of that? I gotta jack their cars up while we're practicing.
Way too much time.
Yeah, way too much time. They're all great. When did this all start for you? Because
first of all, when I was in Boston, when I was a rookie, those guys, they tortured me, those guys. So I learned all those tricks from those guys.
Oh, my God. It started before that.
Yeah.
So mom has to go back to work, right? So she comes back after she had stopped working, raising children. She's a widow, so she goes back to work. She comes home and she turns the faucet on with the kitchen sink. And he put elastic bands around the the sprayer for the dishes. So when she turned it on, it shot her right in her brand new dress, chest. And she freaking lost it. And mom was tough too.
Who pranks their own mother?
Yeah, I know. Well, he's trying to prank me.
I didn't mean to get her. Yeah,
he was trying to get me. And then another time when I thought I was being real cool and. Tenth grade, my teammates and I started chewing Red Man, the leafy tobacco.
Yeah.
So I'm walking around with chew in my mouth, and I have to get somebody to drive me to practice. So Jeff's driving me to practice, and I put a chew in. And halfway to practice, my face and my body is on fire. He's filled the whole thing with Tabasco sauce. He had to pull over to a corner store, and I got a soda, and I drank that thing. I never chewed again after that. It burnt the shit out of my mouth.
It always, Jeff, sort of borderlines on criminal. Like, it's just to the edge, huh?
Yeah.
It's just to the edge. You got to, the story who was your neighbor there? You lived in a big, beautiful house in Victoria. And you had a neighbor who was a bit of a show-off about all his decorations for Halloween or Christmas or something?
Yeah, well, that basically his wife started trying to pull these pranks on me, so she thought that was funny, but she made the mistake. And so my sons and I were driving to I'd watched her husband for 2 weekends decorate his house with Christmas lights. Right. And I'm not kidding, it took him 2 full weekends. And they had, like, lights everywhere, extension cords. They had, like, the Santa Claus and the reindeer and snowman out in the front yard, the blow-up ones. And so on a Saturday night, it's about 6 o'clock, and we were driving to my boys. I coached both my boys on the hockey team in Victoria. And I saw them. He had a tuxedo on, and she had a long evening gown on, and they were getting into their car, and so I was like thinking, on the way to the rink, I was like, okay, I got it. So after the game was over, I got them to bring 2 other kids from the team. So on the way home, I backed my truck into his driveway. I took every light off his house, every extension cord. I took all the Santa Claus, the reindeer, everything. And I set it up at my house. And so I had lights stringing everywhere. I had their Santa Claus I didn't know they had gone to a big benefit dinner for the Arts Foundation in Victoria, and they brought everyone back to their house to see their Christmas lights. Well, I guess he pulls into his driveway and the lights aren't on. He's like going, what the hell is going on? And then he notices that nothing's there. So at about 11:30 at night, the police knock on my door. I come down and the police are there, and I can see them standing out at my gate. So anyways, I said to the policeman, he goes, yeah, I got a complaint that you stole someone's Christmas lights. And I'm looking at him, and he goes, somebody must be playing a joke. And he goes, well, the extension cord's plugged into your garage. I said, yeah, but I didn't do that. Somebody must be joking around. So anyway, the cop just got back in his car and left, and they were standing out of the gate, and I yelled out, payback's a bitch.
What happened to you when you were a rookie in Boston? What'd they do to you?
Oh, so I played with Guy Lapointe. He was like one of the biggest pranksters that I played with. So like they were nonstop screwing my shoes to the bench, cutting one leg off. If I fell asleep on the plane, they would cut my tie. We flew to LA private. First time it was commercial, that's right. So I fell asleep on the plane and I had taken my shoes off. We get into LA and I can't find my shoes anywhere. So I wait, everyone gets off the plane. I'm looking everywhere on the plane. So I walk through LAX in my bare feet. Yeah. And I freaking get to the baggage terminal there, and there's my shoes going around the baggage belt. So yeah, they did stuff like that to me nonstop.
Hey,
you're probably asking yourself, how do I get a hold of these guys? You're going to email us, thesuspendables@yahoo.com, and like and share on our Facebook page, would you? We've gone to a lot of work. First of all, a sort of semi-serious thing. When did you, we've had lots of conversations with Russ. When in your hockey career did you, can you sort of remember the first time going, fuck, I got a shot here to make the NHL and maybe win a Stanley Cup one day?
Probably when Russ and I played junior together. I think that, I never thought, even when I was 19,
right.
I thought I was done, and because I didn't get drafted, nobody was talking to me. And then Russ got traded to Victoria, so I came back to play overage, and then Russ and I just basically, lit it up together. We both got lots of points. And so by Christmas, I could have signed with pretty much, most teams in the NHL that year.
Yeah, right. That's awesome.
So when I signed with Boston, I thought I definitely had a chance to make it then.
And if anybody looked at me on the ice, fuck, Jeff just beat the shit out of him. He was not only getting a lot of points, it was drawing a lot of attention to how good a fighter he was. And like, he fought all the tough guys in the league that year, and it was unbelievable. But I never forget, I didn't know some of the players, especially out east. So we went out on the eastern swing. You take the bus all right at the beginning of the season. We played in Seattle and drove the bus straight to Winnipeg or Brandon, and then we work our way back.
Jesus, yeah.
And we're in Regina, so we played Brandon, Winnipeg, Regina. Then we go to Saskatoon.
Prince Albert.
I don't know if Calgary have a team then, but anyways, and then Lethbridge and Medicine Hat, all that. So
fuck, what a road trip.
Oh yeah, Jesus. It's unbelievable. It's like 10, 12 days on a bus and crappy hotels. But
McDonald's every day.
Yeah, McDonald's every day.
Right.
So I hit Al Tour in the corner in Regina, and I didn't realize he was a tough guy. And so I run him in the corner. I was all of 170 pounds maybe, soaking wet.
Right.
And I'm skating back, and I see Jeff go the other way, and I turn around, and Al Tour is chasing me with no gloves on, and he's going to kill me. And Jeff intercepted him, and they just had a wicked scrap. And so stuff like that started drawing attention. And then the way we played together, we just knew where each other were. And Jeff had, I think, 130 or 40 points. I can't remember. And wow. I had 97 or something, and I got drafted.
I think you had more points than me that year.
No, you did. Because remember, I broke my wrist at Christmas.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So I think I had more points in the playoffs. It was Mark Morrison and then me, I think. Anyway, something like that. But Jeff and I played really well together. We had this guy named Stu Kulak on our wing. And we used to, Jeff would dump it around behind the net. And Stu would just absolutely run over guys. He hit a guy so hard. We had those perforated jerseys back then.
Right.
The guy looked like cheesecloth. His face was just completely messed up. And Stu ended up playing in Vancouver. And we had a really good team that year. We unfortunately didn't make it all the way, but we had a good team.
What conversations did you guys have, Rusty and Jeff, when you were growing up, talking about, playing junior together, and then just as I asked Jeff, at what point did you think, fuck, we got a shot here? But take us back there to the two of you guys talking. Did you lean on each other a little bit? Who was giving who advice? How did you guys sort of handle that as young guys?
Well, Jeff looked after me. I was 17 years old, and
and Lippy, Christ.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, and so I was 17 and he was 20, and he'd been in the league 3 years, two full years and maybe a half year. I can't remember, but he knew the ropes and he looked after me and protected me on the ice and made me feel comfortable and gave me confidence. It was awesome. And then what was starting to happen was we had a lot of good players at that time in the draft, that were rated, like Cam Neely and Alfie Turcotte and a few other, Dan Hodgson, and so the scouts were out there watching, and so they were watching. My ratings kept getting higher, and the more scouts who came actually got to see Jeff, you know, like, holy, the transformation of this guy. And he put on a lot of weight over the summer, working out, and was fighting, and still getting a lot of points. So we both drew attention in a different fashion, you know, him being undrafted and me potentially being drafted.
Right.
So it was great. And you know, it was an odd time. Like, Jeff, I think he didn't think he was going to make it. So he had started like a fence building company, a hauling business. And I'm like taking afternoon naps for a game. And he's out doing oil changes for guys on our team for like 10 bucks and 20 bucks. The guy had all these laid off family members, our uncle and our friends who were laid off at that time in the 80s. And they were working for Jeff. And he had these companies, you know, he's making the, at that time, he's making really good money. And so his mind was probably in a different area than mine. He's like, and the better he played, the longer the season went on, then I think, you know, I let Jeff answer, but, you know, then he probably started thinking, I've got a chance. But he kept those companies alive in the offseason.
You got to understand, we had no money. So basically I built a fence for my ex-wife's family and ended up doing their whole street. And then...
No, hang on. Where did you learn that?
My dad taught me when I was young.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he taught me. Basically, he used to build fences and patios and do renovations with all his buddies. They'd do each other's work on the weekends. And so he'd always take me. I went with him all the time and just got learning that. So I did that. And then I opened up... And then I started to... I realized that, you know, people all needed stuff hauled to the dump. So I put an ad in the paper, student hauling, and it was like nonstop. And it was, you know, it'd be like $200 a load. And
or was it? Was
that?
Oh, fuck, you only paid me $20. I got you owe me some money.
Yeah, I was paying them $20 an hour and making $75. It was a good deal.
Yeah, that a boy.
So I was doing that stuff to basically support Russ so he could go out on the nights off. And basically it was kind of crazy. I mean, I worked before practice, after practice I'd go for lunch and then work again. And then because I had just graduated from school, so had to do something. But then that year that I played with Russ, like, we literally, we were a really good line. I mean, it didn't matter whether we had, it didn't matter who we had on the right side, whether, I mean, we played with Sean Green, Stu Kulak. I remember Sean Green. He wasn't the best player. What was the other kid's name?
Steve Bayless.
Yeah. So, you know, it was always good to have somebody with us that was good defensively, but we also would just dump it in their corner and get them to hit somebody, and then we'd make a play and get a chance and score. And as that year went on, I signed at Christmas with Boston, so I knew at that point that I was going to get a chance to play. And then from then on, their scouts were following me everywhere, telling me different things I had to do to improve my game. So it was good.
Yeah, cool. When you guys had your event in Victoria, where you raised all that money for mental illness, and I was part of that. You invited me to be part of that. Is there not a story, Jeff, where you were maybe into a development deal, and you had to clear some trees? I remember you telling me and then you had all the pine cone eaters, all the environmentalists freaking out about you. And I remember when I came to do your event, you didn't know what to do about it, and you sat me at their table for the dinner. And I ended up telling them, you went, go in there and give them the business. And I pulled out my wallet and said, look it, I got this made out of a baby seal pup. And I remember Jeff sitting at the table beside me, pumping the fist, going, you go, Jerome. Was that kind of a real story?
We bought 6,000 acres from Timber West that was 80% logged, but we logged the last 15% of it, and they didn't, you know, the they didn't realize you need toilet paper from trees and everything else. So they didn't like us doing that. So they attacked us. But anyway, we ended up, we replanted the entire property, and it's a friend of mine from Arizona owns it now. And, it's growing every year, and he'll harvest it again in probably 10 years and they'll get mad at him. So that's okay.
Yeah, there you go. When you won the cup, Jeff, in it was in 88, right? Cause I was here.
Yeah.
Tell us about that whole experience. What did you guys start to get the cup back then? Like, I know a lot, right? Players take it now for 2-3 days or something. There it is. There's the White Claw. Do you remember? Obviously, you remember winning it. And what about that summer? Take us through those days.
I'll take you through the year. First of all, I was playing on a line with Kenny Linsman and Cam Neely in Boston, and it was the first year that I did not think that I was, every year before that in Boston, I thought I was getting traded because I didn't really play a lot there. Mm-hmm. And then the deadline came, and I had like 32 goals. Cam had 38. We were on fire. Like, we were the best line in Boston. And the team was doing great, but I think that they, felt they needed a goalie. And so anyway, I came back to my room that night after a movie with Cam, and all the guys are waiting at my room going, "Hey, have you talked to the coach?" And I'm like, going, "No, about what?"
Oh, fuck.
And they said, "Oh, you better call the coach." So I called him, and he said they traded me. It was a bit of a shock. But anyway, I go to Edmonton, and I thought I was in great shape until I skated with those guys. Their practices were so fast and so intense.
Were you happy that you got traded to Edmonton?
Yeah, I mean, it was because of exactly that. When I got traded there, I thought, wow, okay, this is a good team. They got a chance to win the cup. And I played with Fierzy and Junior, so knew him well. But, to get there and play with Wayne and Mark and the guys on the team who were just such great leaders, it was just a great experience. And I think that winning the cup, I mean, that team, it was so exciting. I mean, we only lost 2 games the whole playoff, and to beat Boston in the final.
Oh, there you go.
It was very enjoyable.
Say there was a coach, right, Slats?
Yeah.
And what about your experience with him? I know people have told me that he just kept guys' heads spinning. That Slats would be like, "Okay, go out and party, you guys, and then, to relax because we're winning a bunch, go get in some trouble." And then when you did, he'd say, "What the fuck's everyone getting in trouble for? Okay, curfew." That he would just, I mean, he just was a unique coach, Jeff. Like, no one knew where he was coming from. Is that right?
Yeah, he was a player's coach. I think that, he let guys live and just demanded the most out of his players, ran good practices, and I think got a lot of respect from a lot of guys. And I think that... I wasn't there that long. I was only there the last 11 games of the season and then the playoffs. So, didn't probably get enough time to see a lot of that stuff. But I thought that that team was a very, very powerful team that year.
Did you learn anything from Gretz directly that we don't know? People talk about playing with Wayne and go, I just can't tell you what it was like. It's just so good. And Yari and those guys.
Well, I think the biggest thing that I learned from Wayne and Mark, but mainly Wayne, was how important each piece is. Like Wayne would always say, it takes 20 guys to win, and he was so good at building guys up, making guys feel like they were such a big part of it. I went that whole playoff without a goal. It was pretty frustrating. Mm-hmm. But, I played with Craig McTavish and Norm Lacombe. Our job was mainly to go out there and shut guys down and run around and hit. But Wayne basically made us feel like, and lots of other guys in, roles like mine, like we were such a big part of it. But it was just Wayne... You could just see why he was first of all, his talent's unbelievable, but his attitude as far as positive winning is probably the greatest I've ever seen. One of the things that I've read a lot about is winners think they can and they do, and Wayne's like the ultimate example of that. Right. he basically would think in his mind, okay, we're going to win this game, and he would do whatever it took to win that game. And that's basically what leadership's all right. about.
Like you always said, Russ, the what separates the great from the good was the great guys just never settle for anything, right?
Mm-hmm. Mess was like that too.
Yeah.
Mess was probably more right. emotional than Wayne. Like he would get upset at, you know, and tell everybody if he was upset, and he would cheer us on. And when I played with both of them in New York, Mark was the one that really was vocal, and Wayne was very quiet, but did his thing on the ice. And then Mark was very, you know, if he didn't like something, he'd tell us, or vice versa. If he liked something, you know, he was good. They were both different, both great.
But you told a story a few shows ago about when you coached, and did you sit a kid or something? That story about where the kid was lipping off refs and shit like that, and you did you sit him or something?
No, the kid was slamming his stick on the ice and he'd come back to the bench, and he would hit the bench, right. the boards with his stick. And I told him, I said, stop that. He didn't. And I said, if you keep it up, because the right. stick's $300 or whatever. And I said that, you know, your parents paid for that. You're disrespecting the game. I said, if you do it again, you're not going to play the rest of the game you're going to play without the stick. So he did it again. And I sent him out there for the face-off. And the ref's like, he has to have a stick. And I go, where in the rule book does it say he has to have a stick? And they go, well, if you don't give him his stick, I'm going to give your team a penalty. And I go, okay. All right. I go, Mitch, come over here. Sit right here. And the defenseman I sent out, I go, as soon as they drop the puck, I want you to sprint to this bench. And it was in our own zone, in the defensive zone. And this kid sprints off. And I'm going, Mitch, get out there. And he skated around for a minute and a half with no stick. And the poor kid was in tears. And in between periods, and I said, Mitch, I freaking love you. You're like right. one of my favorite players, and my own son's on the team, and he's all emotional. I got emotional, right. and I said, but you can't do that. You just can't do that, and I will not allow you to do it. And if you keep it up, you're not going to play right. on my team, even though I love you.
The reason I bring it up, because Jeff, you coached, right? And I thought, fuck, I wonder what it's like playing for Jeff Courtnell, right? But I know how absolutely hilariously crazy funny you are. And how was that experience, Jeff, coaching?
Oh, it was good. I mean, I was pretty serious with coaching the kids. Right. I mean, obviously, both my sons were on my Bantam team, and then Midget was Justin. And then I coached junior for 2 years with Justin on that team. And, I think we were lucky. Our dad coached us when we were young, and he was an amazing coach. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot from him. And I think that, that's why we had the success we did when we were older, because when we were young, he basically, you know, coached us every Saturday morning at father and son hockey. And then also, I mean, he coached Russ's teams most of the time, so I would actually either see the practice or be out there. And then same with hockey schools in the summer, he coached right. us. So I think that, you know, basically I found my success coaching came from repetition of making sure the kids, you know, did lots of the same drills but at high intensity, and passing was obviously the most important right. thing.
So Rusty always talked about one of the difficult problems with coaching is every kid thinks he should be on the first line.
No, but the parents do.
Yeah. That's right. How did you handle that, Jeff, when you got these kids who were so good in Pee Wee and Adam and Midget and Bantam, and then they come to play junior, and of course they all, like Rusty always said, they racked up points, they were the best player on their team, and then they come to play at the next level, and now you got to talk to these kids going, you're not a first liner.
I think it was always, yeah, I think the parents made it more difficult than anything because they were in their kid's ear. But I think that, you know, I coached Bantam. I had like six of the probably the best players on the island top players for sure on the island. And, you know, the parents didn't like it that I didn't, because when they're 14 years old, this draft for Bantam for junior is kind of crazy. But, you know, that's when these parents think if their kid doesn't get drafted to the junior leagues that he's not going to play or whatever.
Right.
So I found that my guys, you know, what I personally thought was the only way my guys were going to get exposure is if we went a long ways in the playoffs. And the only way we were going to go a long ways in the playoffs is if my younger players improved a lot during the season. So I played everybody equal throughout the season and just worked and worked and worked on everything with everybody. Mm-hmm. And we didn't finish in the top three, my guy, you know, including my son. They didn't get tons of points. I think he was the only one on that team that got drafted in the Western League draft. But in the playoffs, we beat everyone on the island, and then we lost in the semifinals in Vancouver in the BCs. Actually, we lost to North Shore Winter Club, who had like Kyle Turris and the top kids that were like really good. So anyways, my kids got the team got a lot more exposure by doing well in the playoffs than just racking up a bunch of points. And a lot of them went on to play junior. So
why did you stop coaching, Jeff?
I coached when Justin was,
two sons, right?
In junior. Yeah. And Adam, my oldest, he wasn't playing. He was going to University of Calgary, and Justin played 2 years in BC junior. I coached him. I liked it. And I did have guys who obviously that I know in management in the NHL asked me if I wanted to go coach in the minors, but I just I just didn't want to do it because I just didn't want to go travel on the bus again. And, Justin's road trips in the American League are pretty long. And so I just really didn't want to go do that. And I didn't want to coach junior anymore. So kind of stopped at that point.
I read a piece this morning, Jeff, about you. I know you personally. I've known you a long time and known Russ. And it was an excellent article. Some of it was video with you talking about your dark days. You got concussed. You had to quit the game because of concussion syndrome. And you when you read this article, it's hard to believe that they never did anything back when you played about concussions. And now you're an advocate for awareness about it. Talk about that, Jeff, for a minute.
Well, I think obviously, you know, post-concussion syndrome back when I got it wasn't really as well known as it is today or as much known about So, you know, I basically was in trouble and for 6 to 8 weeks after it first happened, I was like pretty much didn't leave the house. Was if I got up out of bed, I felt sick. And
when was that, Jeff, in the first time it happened?
That was in 98, 99 was the first one that I got. And I missed 50 games that year. And then I came back, played in the playoffs. And then the next year I started the start of the season, I felt great. And then I got knocked out again. And the problem is that as you get these concussions, more and more of them, they happen easier. I played hard and, you know, I hit lots of guys. And so basically I kind of, in my own mind, I don't really signal one hit. Obviously the one that put me out for the longest was Nolan sucker punching me. But I think that there's lots of other concussions and hits that I took before that because that really, I had lots of harder knockouts and hits than that one. But anyway, I think that what happens is you basically, when you get forced to retire and you can't finish out what you're in the middle of doing as a career and you have more goals and that's taken away from you, it's pretty depressing. So when I had to retire you know, I think that that was pretty hard time for me when I wasn't really ready to mm-hmm. do it. So I think that it just led to tough times. Right.
Did you see that happening, Russ and Jeff, when you saw these injuries? And did you, I mean, you must have been scared shitless, Jeff, as a, or Russ as a brother. And did you have talks about it? Thinking maybe you got to talk to Jeff about this and maybe he has to step away?
He lived in St. Louis and, you know, played in St. Louis, lived there, and then Seattle, and I was in L.A., so I didn't see him, you know. Mm-hmm. I saw him once in a while, and but by the time I saw him, he seemed normal, you know, like he wasn't getting sick and stuff, and he's a proud guy, so he probably hid all the symptoms from us. And definitely, you know, he had changed a bit. And his personality had changed a bit, but you know, by the time we were living, I then moved to Victoria in 2003, and we then spent a lot of time together, and I didn't right. really recognize anything that was out of whack.
Right, Jeff, you've been pretty open over the years talking about a problem you had with booze, and because I read a bunch of stuff this morning and last night. And at some point you decided you needed to talk about it?
I didn't ever think I had a problem. Right. But I mean, I'm 10 years sober now, so it's pretty easy to realize that obviously I did. I think that, you know, when it causes disruptions and problems in your life, I think that you got a problem. And, you know, with me, I think that I just have that energy that when I started drinking, I didn't want to stop, and basically, you know, just got myself into lots of situations where I wasn't happy, and you know, I think that I just drank to forget about all the negative things in my life, and then when I quit doing it, it was a tough thing to quit for a year. And then after the first year, I started to really see the difference in how I felt. And so, you know, now it's easy. I mean, I get my highs from working out.
Right. I'm 10 years sober too. So I totally understand that. I fucking drank so much when my kids were growing up, they thought I had an accent.
Yeah.
My drinking, I don't know what yours are like, but you know, when I drank, I don't know how this always happened. You talked about your shoes, you know, that they left on the plane. I often, when I drank, I'd lose my shoes. I don't know how. There were so many other things that could happen. But they were they were crazy fun days. I had asked you earlier and didn't get an answer. The year they won the Stanley Cup, how did you spend the summer? Did you have that cup?
Yeah. No, that was fun. I mean, obviously, it was a party the whole summer, but then I got involved in a whole contract negotiation where I became a free agent and then got in signed with New York, and it was complicated because Edmonton ended up getting the rights to match the contract, which they shouldn't have because I was an unrestricted free agent. And then Edmonton matched it, traded me to Washington. So it was kind of like a crazy summer because I was partying and having fun because I won the cup, but I didn't really know, you know, what was going on. And God, I remember, here, I'll tell you a great story. Pocklington came on the plane in Edmonton when we started the playoffs that year, and he said, if you guys win the cup this year, I'll give you a trip or two anywhere in the world and $1,000. So anyways, you know, I didn't even think anything of it. And so we win the cup, and then I'm going, oh man, okay, so we're getting our bonuses for winning. And then they said, oh yeah, you got to book your trip on Air Canada, wherever Air Canada flies, and $1,000, but you got to use it by September.
Right.
So I flew to Seattle and back so I could get the $1,000.
Oh no.
How times have changed.
Oh, that's my so God. Funny. Yeah, no, that was funny. But anyway, I just remembered that story from that summer. Because it was a crazy summer. I was like, my head was spinning. I didn't know where the hell. I didn't have friggin' 2 weeks to go on a trip anywhere, let alone friggin' get it done by September. But I sure as hell wasn't going to lose $1,000.
That's so funny. I'll build a fence for it. I'll build another fence. Yeah. Give me a... Kevin Lowe and Mark Messier talk. Kevin he had his family here and his sisters, and they, you know, Vish was his nickname, and they used to tease the shit out of him because his sister would clean his house and look after picking up his fucking dry cleaning and everything for him. And of course, Mess was just running for his life all the time. You know, he just played every day as it came. And they decided they were going to go to Hawaii after they won the Stanley Cup. I don't know, it might have been they both would have been there in 88, right? Of course. And yeah. And Kevin says, well, let's fuck off. Let's go to Hawaii. And so Kevin's sister packs all his bags. He's got the matching luggage, Rusty. He's got the safari suit on. And he's at the airport an hour and a half early. And he's standing on the sidewalk, you know, looking like a tourist, waiting for Mess to pull up. And there's no Mess, you know? There's no Mess. And he's no cell phones back then. And Kevin tells the story. He's freaking out. And all of a sudden, with about half an hour to go, like, Kevin's going, fuck, he won't be able to check in, you know? And a cab comes screaming up with Mess in the back of the cab and just like a pair of Adidas shorts. No shirt, okay? He's putting his T-shirt on. He jumps out of the cab. And he goes, let's go. And Kevin says, where's all your shit? And he pulls out a black American Express card and goes, I'm packed. Let's go. I'm ready. You know?
Oh, my God. That's
crazy days.
Hunter and Semenko, Sammy told me the story that they wanted to go on those Hawaii trips because after they would win the cup, a bunch of the guys would go over to Hawaii and they didn't want to bring their wives. So they told their wives they were going fishing up north. So Hunts would pick up Sammy or Sammy would pick up Hunts, and they'd do the exact same. The opposite, though, they would pack for fishing, throw it in the truck, and go to the airport and just
pack for fishing
with a carry-on. They would go to Hawaii. They'd go to Hawaii, and they would sit in the shade for a week because they didn't want to get a tan. Because up north, it was cold and, you know, cloudy or whatever. And a bunch of the wives were on the trip. So they spent the week ducking the other. They couldn't hang out with their team because Sammy's like, every time we saw them, we were like running for another palm tree.
Oh, man. I love that. One of the great stories I ever heard was the wife is going through the guy's suits, you know, to get them cleaned. And she finds this phone number in there, right? It says, like, Judy with the fucking phone number. And she runs at her husband when he comes home and says, hey, what is this here? And the guy pauses, you know, he scratches his head and he goes, well, you know, I like the horses, honey. You know, I love to go bet the horses. And that's the name of the horse, Judy. And that's the bib number, that's the race number, and those are the odds, all those numbers. And she goes, oh, okay, I guess. A week later, she finds the same slip of paper, and the guy comes home and she goes, dear, I need to tell you something. Your horse called. the stuff guy. Well, Sammy told the story. He went away, you know, in his drinking days, and he went away and he was always fighting with his wife, and he got dropped off by the cab, and he walked in the house, and then he walked out and told the cab he's at the wrong house because there was no furniture, but it was actually the right house. His wife or girlfriend moved out while he was away on the road trip and didn't tell him. Jeff, this was great, man. Tell us about what you're doing these days and where your kids are and everything and where you're living and all that.
I'm living in Vancouver enjoying the beautiful city. And the last 3 months, I haven't been doing very much other than working around the house and riding my bike. I hiked this morning up at Cypress and my son Adam is over in Victoria building houses, so I saw him last weekend. I try to get over there every once in a while and see my mom. And my youngest son Justin is living in Dallas, and he's enjoying it down there, although it's been pretty difficult lately.
Sure. You're a fitness freak. I guess 8, 9, 10 years ago, you ran the Boston Marathon in under 3.5 hours.
Yeah, I ran that in 3:14. I ran Victoria in 2:58.
Jesus.
So I ran about 6 marathons. Great story. I was in downtown Victoria walking around, and I used to run a bit, but I didn't.
Like you, Russ, running every day and exercising all day in the gym.
And I ran into Donnie Lalonde, the fighter. And Russ and I are good friends with him. And I said, "Hey, what are you doing in town?" He says, "Oh, I've been training. I'm going to run the marathon tomorrow." I said, "Really? Where do you register?"
Oh, come on.
And he goes, "Oh, down at the Empress." So I went with him and I registered and I ran it in 3:20. and so he goes, "What the hell? You ran it 3:20? I was like 3:50. And I said, "Okay, yeah, well, that was pretty good." But I then thought, okay, I can break 3 hours. I got to train. So I trained for it. And I think on my fourth one, I broke 3 hours. But my goal was always to run the Boston. So it was phenomenal to run that race.
How do you spend your days now? Are you working out all day long now or what?
No. Oh, okay. I ride my bike either 4 times a week or I hike. And a couple days a week, I try to do weights. But nothing crazy. Like I might work out an hour a day, but I like to try to work out every day, do something just because it makes me feel better.
Who wins in a fight, Rusty, you or Jeff?
Jeff. The real question is who would win the fight between Bruce and Jeff?
Right.
Bruce is the silent assassin. He's unbelievable.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Those two would have a hell of a fight.
Yeah, when he was a kid, I used to fight him all the time in the pool at our house in the backyard, and I'd, you know, obviously I was a lot bigger than him, so I know how tough he is because I trained him to be tough when he was young.
Who's age wise? Where do you guys fit in? Who's youngest? Who's oldest?
My sister's the oldest. She's actually 60 today.
Oh, 60 today and, as we record?
Yeah, yeah, and. I'll be 58 in August.
Yep.
Russ, I think, had just turned 55. And Bruce is 53 in September.
He's the baby.
Yeah.
But Rusty always said he has as much talent as the two of you.
Well, Jeff was a late bloomer, but Bruce was really late. And then he got into fighting in the WHL. You know, he just was so freaking good at it. And so he became the tough guy. And he didn't mind fighting for himself, but he didn't like getting the tap on the shoulder, going, go beat up that guy, because he just picked on Johnny at the end of the bench. And so that really bothered him, because when he fought, it was ugly. Like, he was that guy, like Wendell Clark, where he fought and he absolutely beat the shit out of guys. And then... my sister takes her boyfriend at the time to a game in Port Alberni, in Nanaimo, which is a tough town. And Bruce she's going, "I want you to come watch my brother play hockey." And he beat the guy from the face-off dot over to the penalty box and dropped him in a pool of blood and then stepped in the box and then turned and waved to my sister and her boyfriend like, "Hey, how you doing?" When people saw Bruce fight, they were like, "How is this really nice, goofy kid such a great fighter?" Anyways, he learned from Jeff. So anyway, he was really, really he is really freaking tough.
The quiet ones.
We had a really good instructor, Tom Black. I mean, seriously, deserves a lot of credit for me making it, because when I was 19 years old, Kevin Shamhorn's dad, who was a scout with LA, came up and met with me in Victoria, and he said, "Hey, you could play in the NHL, but you got to put on 20 pounds, you got to learn how to fight, and you got to stand up for yourself." So basically, Tom Black, that summer I lifted weights like 4 days a week at the Y to gain 20 pounds. Tom Black basically taught me how to fight. And so I would spar and box with him like three times a week. And then Bruce basically learned how to fight from him. And he was just a great teacher, great man. He was a lacrosse player, but he was really, really tough. So anyway, he gave me that confidence to really get to where I got to.
Rusty told a story one day that you guys got in a bar fight, didn't you?
No, that was Bruce. Now, Jeff was in the playoffs in Vancouver, and Bruce and I went out because I obviously didn't make the playoffs that year. I think it was with Minnesota. And so I flew out to Vancouver to play golf for 10 days, watch Jeff play, and Bruce and I were going to have this, you know, great trip in Vancouver and our hometown in Victoria. Right. And Bruce was living in Vancouver, and we went to Steve Sheridan's bar.
Kit's Pub
or something like that. And Bruce got in a fight with the bouncer, and this bystander patron of the bar thought that Steve and I were about to fight. And I was arguing with Steve because he's our friend, and we just spent 4 hours drinking with him. And I'm like, get your bouncer. Yeah, we were overserved. And the worst part, we sat in the kitchen and drank and just caught up. We hadn't seen each other in a long time. Anyways, this guy sucker punched me. And then Bruce and I were both going at it, and we got in the cab and went home. And we had to phone Jeff the next morning and said, hey, this is what happened.
And Bruce looks just like me.
So we were worried that they thought it was Jeff Courtnell. So Jeff went to Pat Quinn and said, hey, Pat, if anyone calls you that I was in a fight last night, it wasn't me, it was my brother.
Tell the story, Jeff, about your experiences with Brian Burke.
Oh my God. Burkey. Well, first of all, when I was playing in Boston, he was going to Harvard, so he would always come over to practice, and when he was graduating from law school, he wanted me to be one of his first clients. And
you guys knew him from Victoria, your days as juniors? Or?
No, just I met him in Boston. Oh, okay. And then he was, so he was there, and he would come, and I'd go for beers with him after practice all the time. And, you know, I was making like, I don't know, $70,000 a year, and Harry Sinden was like the toughest guy to negotiate with at that time. So anyways, Berkey said to me, well, you can just sit out and I'll negotiate you a great contract. Well, what he didn't realize is that, you know, there was two guys on the team, Ray Bourque, and I probably think Rick Middleton, maybe, right. I don't know who else, maybe Barry Peterson, that had different contracts than the rest of us. And the rest of us were all making the exact same money. But anyway, I laughed. That's how I became friends with Berkey, and then he was assistant GM when we were in Vancouver. So he was always joking around with me, and you know, we were good friends, and yeah, I think that Berkey learned a lot from Pat Quinn, and that combination actually gave us that team that we had in 94.
Didn't you get called onto the carpet when Berkey was in the front office as a disciplinary guy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he suspended me. I wasn't happy about that.
Tell us about that.
Oh, man. Oh, well, I used to go at it all the time with Joel Otto, so he was, you know, sticking me, and I two-handed him in the leg or knee or arm or whatever, so he was hurt for a minute and then came back out after.
Oh, yeah.
So anyway, I get the call. Yeah. And so anyways, Berkey's got me on the phone in Pat's office, and I basically started yelling at him because he had just left. Like, he was the assistant GM the year before for Vancouver, and then he's the disciplinarian guy in New York, and he's friggin' anyway. You know, I think Otto was one of his buddies, too. So he ended up suspending me for a couple games, so I wasn't happy about that. So I was yelling and screaming at him.
You talk about, Jeff, before you go, you guys, that event you had, the fishing derby that you had, what you guys have done for mental illness has really set an example for all of us, really, about stepping up. And talk about that place now, Jeff, in Victoria. I know Russ has mentioned it before, but we haven't talked about it in a long time, about that event.
Well, I think two things that, you know, I think it was the way we were raised, first of all, and we also really appreciated, you know, when we were kids growing up, meeting guys that played in the NHL and then basically having the careers we had and then being able to give back in the way we did. I think that if you look at the first event that Russ and I hosted here in Vancouver was the Courtnell Classic for Canuck Place. Right. Canuck Place is a hospice for terminally ill children and their families in Vancouver. And we basically, a family donated the house to the Canucks. The Canucks were responsible for the renovations and also maintaining it in the go forward. And so Russ and I raised all the money that it took to do the renovations to get it open. Amazing. And a lot of the construction companies got behind us. And we had that fishing derby 3 years in a row. And that was such a phenomenal cause. And then when we retired, we moved to Victoria. And, you know, I think that there was just this opportunity to give back and do something then, because we had gotten some exposure from mental health stuff with my dad. And I think, you know, what we've created in Vancouver Island with the Archie Courtnell Center, you know, a lot of people from all over have come and looked at it for their town or country or wherever it is. But it's just a facility that takes people that are in dire need of stability when they're going through a mental health breakdown. Mm-hmm. And then the money we raised for the new mental health ward at the hospital is you know, phenomenal. Like, I think for people to be able to come into the Archie Courtnell Center and get stabilized and then 2 days later or a day later get transferred over to the new mental health ward. Yep. And then successfully get healthy, you know, and then there's still lots more work to do after that. But our events have always, you know, Russ is in LA, and so we always get lots of great celebs and musicians, right, and
average MCs.
Yeah, fuck off.
That, well, yeah. My God, it was so good. But I think, you know what, back to the raising the money for mental health, what amazed Jeff and Bruce and I and everybody was, you know, we thought we were going to raise a couple hundred grand, we were going to hopefully raise a couple hundred grand, and we raised millions of dollars. And what we didn't realize was that everyone in the room, all of us around the world, but everyone in that room all those years knew somebody in their family or a friend that has suffered or is suffering from mental health issues. And so people, whether they were buying a ticket or for the dinner or golf spot or donating at the radiothon or buying an auction item, they were doing it because it hit home. Mm-hmm. And we didn't realize that when we did it. Like, we did because it affected our family, but we didn't realize how many people and our friends like started coming up to us and saying, "Oh my God, you guys are, you know, you won't believe it. Like, my aunt or my dad or me or my sister or my brother." And when we first announced we were doing it, I would go to Starbucks. Every day I'd drive to Oak Bay Starbucks and back, and it'd take like 20 minutes or whatever to go there and back. Mm-hmm. It was taking me 3 hours because people were like, take me aside and tell these horrific stories that they hadn't told anyone. Mm-hmm. Personal stories. And so it just erupted, and it was so fantastic because we did it as a community. We just happened to, you know, unfortunately we're in that category of we lost our dad to suicide. And then this all happened when we finally told our story. Right. I think Jeff publicly told it first in the media, and then I told my story, and, you know, we each have a different story because it affects you at a different age and it affects you differently.
Right.
No matter if you're siblings, it's, you know, it's different for my sister because of what she was going through in her life. And my younger brother was, you know, Bruce, our younger brother, was so young that he to this day asks us questions about dad.
Right.
Because he can't remember. And Jeff and I had him long enough that we, you know, we remember everything.
I remember Jeff. It was you and Russ actually, because that Canuck House thing was that fishing derby that I went up to 1 year, and I remember you said, "If you think you have problems, come with me, kid," and you walked me through that Canuck House with with kids who were terminally ill, and I just remember coming out of there with my head spinning, going, I got no issues, you know.
Canuck Place.
Yeah,
Canuck Place. It's, you know, it's been another great gift for families in BC and who are going through probably the worst thing they've ever gone through in their lives, and that's having a child being terminally ill, which is just something you would never, ever want to have to go through. Right.
Boys, this was good. Everyone got along. That's nice.
Jimmy, have you got any new jokes? Because
you know what, Jeff?
I'm you know, it's
that's
interesting.
That's why they're not calling anymore, Jimmy.
No, I mean, it's like, you know, I've heard them all. I've used them all for the last 10 years. I wondered if you had any new ones that I could use, because you just tell the same burden jokes over and over again. You got any new material?
I got a fucking ton of new material.
Are
you kidding?
Give me one.
Well, one of my...
Well, he lives by himself with two cats, so he's got lots of time.
How much material do you think I have? Yeah. Like I said, my favorite this year was me disciplining my kid, my 20-year-old, yelling at him, and him rolling his fucking eyes at me. And I said, one day you're going to have kids of your own. And he said, so are you.
That's great.
Mom was knocking down the pool boy. No, I'm kidding. I don't know. Jeff, this was great, man. We finally got this all put together, and it was really great to have you on. You're fucking hilarious still, and we're going to get you on again. Carry on, brother. Good job.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, that was great, Rusty. Finally, a smart Courtnell on the show. Jesus. It's been a long time. I've been having to deal with you. You know, you're a handful.
You, what?
Jeff, you know, I've got a fucking million jokes, and Jeff hit me with the, do you have any new jokes? And I froze.
Yeah.
I froze. I had nothing. Yeah. I told the same stupid joke I told a month ago about my kid. Well done, Rusty. It was great to have Jeff on. Obviously, you guys have a fantastic relationship, and it really came through in the interview. So that's another suspendables in the book. How many White Claws was it, Russ?
Three
White Claw show. That's good.
An hour and 12 minutes. It's a long show.
Another alcohol induced show in the books.
Oh,
what?
I didn't get to tell you that last year at Gosser, they bought or sold more White Claws than any other location in Idaho. And we're only open for 4 months of the year, 5 months, you know, we're basically 3 months. So I'm like, oh my God, somebody told me that when I got here, and I wasn't surprised. But then we started to do the math. All the other places are open for 12 months, and we were only open for a few.
Yeah, you know what? They should give you a key to that town, whatever it is, Harris or wherever that is. They should make you
Harris.
You should make you the mayor.
Coeur d'Alene.
The mayor of Coeur d'Alene. We'll be back next week with another show of The Suspendables. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, and we'll talk to you later.
The Suspendables is a weekly hockey series with Jim Jerome in Edmonton and Russ Courtnell in LA. A new episode every Tuesday morning on Wooshka, iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow The Suspendables on Facebook and Twitter. Reach us at thesuspendables@yahoo.com. And of course, we appreciate you sharing this podcast with your group of friends.